Coming up on Golf Today, a rare Monday finish on the PGA Tour. The Cognizant Classic in Palm Beach is being stretched to a fifth day to finish the final round. And for Austin Ekroth, worth the wait to get his first win on the PGA Tour. We're going to hear from the champ on the show. How about this? A Tiger sighting in South Florida today. Woods back in action after withdrawing from the Genesis Invitational last month as part of the Seminole Pro member. What makes this a must-play for the pros? We're going to discuss in the show. And we've made it more than a decade to see the return of Anthony Kim to professional golf after finishing last in his LIV debut. Any reason for optimism with AK's comeback? That and more as Golf Today starts now.
Golf Today.
Golf fans getting spoiled today on Golf Channel. We had the final round of the Cognizant Classic at Palm Beaches on the PGA Tour this morning, and more live golf headed your way. It's the 12th playing of the Darius Rucker Intercollegiate from Long Cove Club in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. It gets underway at 2:30 Eastern right here on Golf Channel. So with that, hello and welcome inside our Golf Today studios here with you until 2:30 Eastern time. I'm George Savarikas, and look who we have in the house on set with me. It's Golf Channel senior writer Ryan Lavner. Lav, good to see you.
Good to see you too, George. Been a minute. I don't think I've been in Stamford since December 2022. Normally I have like the Georgia stuff in the background. I actually had to put on pants today to come to work, so it's great to be with you. So
that's a big lifestyle change.
Yeah, it really is.
For you these days. And normally it would be what, a College Central leading you into a college event. We're kind of doing that on Golf Today. We've seen Monday finishes before at the Cognizant Classic at the Palm Beaches. Before we dive into the highlights, just your thought on what we saw to kick off the Florida swing.
I certainly thought it was an interesting tournament. You would have loved to see it obviously finish on Sunday. You can't help but feel for a player like Shane Lowry, who was playing in the final group, then has to wait basically all day in order to get to his final round tee time. You think about Eric Van Rooyen, who started out so hot, 8-under through 10, and then has to hit pause in the middle of his round and wasn't able to sustain that momentum. Jake Knapp, I'm sure, would have played until 9 or 10 o'clock last night. He had cooking so much as well, but that's to take nothing away from Austin Ekroth. The way that he handled himself, we saw it last year at the Nelson, shooting 65 in that final round before getting run down by Jason Day. Then the way he comported himself again today, I thought was incredibly impressive.
17 under the winning score. And remember, they flipped it from a par 70 to 71. Try and make it a little gentler PGA National. And that's why this leaderboard, a stark contrast to years past, Lab.
I thought that was actually a good move to move it to 71. It was a little bit softer this year. Obviously, you had the 2 inches of rain on Sunday, which made scoring a little bit better for the final round as well. It had almost gotten too tough at PGA National, where it was really kicking you in the teeth to start the Florida swing. Then you go to Bay Hill, where you know you're going to have trouble. Then you go to TPC Sawgrass, which you know is one of the most penal golf courses on the planet. I like this kind of gentler start to the Florida swing.
Ekroth certainly loving it with that victory by three at the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches to get his first win on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this afternoon and evaluating my schedule and seeing, you know, what the rest of the season's going to hold. And, you know, it's just a great opportunity upcoming with, you know, what the win does for me. And just, you know, the job security I gained from that as well. Just there's a lot that I really, you know, that this got for me. So
I'm sure most professionals envision this moment, the first championship. What were those visions like for you, and does this live up to that?
Oh, for sure lives up to the, you know, the first win. You know, you can't really visualize what it'd be. You mess around whenever you're a kid on the putting green having putts to win, you know, PGA Tour events and win the Masters and stuff like that. But, you know, coming in today, I've been in this situation before, you know, at the Byron Nelson to where I had a lead. And, you know, I didn't really know what to expect, what the feeling would be. I knew finishing second was heartbreaking, but, you know, I'm not real sure, and I still don't think I'm sure how I feel yet. I know I'm excited, that's it. Yeah, obviously I was in a situation last fall where I was trying to get into those elevated events and make sure I maintained my PGA Tour status, and, you know, obviously just I think I missed all but one cut during that fall series, and to be a winner, not 6 months later, but, I mean, it's insane. I mean, it's a big jump.
What we've seen so far on the PGA Tour this season, 3 rookie winners and 4 first-time winners, and get this, just 9 events, just 1 winner ranked inside the top 50 in the world at the time of the victory, and that was Wyndham Clark at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, which was shortened to 54 holes, and we had the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches with the Monday finish. So Austin Eckroat was just looking it up. Now, the 3rd member of that Oklahoma State national title team to win on the PGA Tour, Matthew Wolff, Victor Hovland, and Austin Eckroat. We knew he had potential. He was always kind of in those guys' shadows in college. Now we're seeing his game on full display.
You and I are on set together, I believe, yeah, for College Central from that 2018 NCAA championship. Yeah, I think that was the sweatiest I have ever seen you, George. And look, Austin Eckroat was a fine college player. He did enough to represent the U.S. at the Walker Cup just a couple years ago. But he was never a prolific winner in college. He was never a Matthew Wolff. He was never even a Victor Hovland on his own team. You think about that national championship team in 2018. He was the 4 or 5 man throughout the rest of that. Even by the time he was a senior, he was still roughly a top 25 player in the college golf rankings. I think that kind of speaks now to the fact that he's a PGA Tour winner. It speaks to the depth that you have on the PGA Tour. By any metric, he was kind of an above-average PGA Tour player. And then when you have the week that he did at PGA National, the best ball striking week of his PGA Tour career to this point, now he becomes a winner. I'm not sure it's necessarily going to resonate, you know, far and wide with casual golf fans, but this is kind of the state that we are in on the PGA Tour and what these full-filled events are supposed to be producing.
And you mentioned the state that we're on the PGA Tour. Let's take a look at the odds of the winners. And that's been a big part of the storyline. The first 4 or 5 events, we said, okay, we've had all these long shots. Chris Kirk, Grayson Murray, you see, he was at 350-1. Nick Dunlap, 400-1. Matthew Pavon, 130-1. The shortest odds of anyone was Jake Knapp at 40-1 to then go on to win that week. Wyndham Clark somehow was 66-1. And I was doing the math with you before the show, Lab. If you had bet $1 on Chris Kirk and just let it ride, the first 4 guys, you'd be a billionaire.
If only we had known.
If only it was like Back to the Future with Biff, we'd be sitting pretty. But that has been week in and week out, the type of winners we've seen. It's nice as part of the schedule, but we're waiting for the stars also to kind of come out of hibernation and emerge. Because if you look at what we saw at the beginning of last year, it was a bunch of players ranked inside the top 10 in the world. John Rahm, Scottie Scheffler, they all won very earlier in the year. You had 6 guys inside the top 50. This year, you've only had 1. So the star power has really been lacking, Lab.
Yeah, I certainly think there's a couple factors here that it's worth diving into. When you have John Rahm win 4 times through the Masters, you have Scottie Scheffler win 2 times through the Masters, that's certainly going to set the tone for the rest of it. And it's really comes down to perception. We're only a couple shots away, at least at this point in the PGA Tour season, from having a Jordan Spieth victory, a Keegan Bradley victory, a Nicolai Hogard victory, Scottie Scheffler, Will Zalatoris, Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele. Like, all of those guys could be PGA Tour winners had things gone just a little bit differently. When you zoom out, you say, yeah, you know, 6 of the 9 winners so far on the PGA Tour have been quote-unquote long shots, 100-1 odds or greater. But when you look at what this reimagined PGA Tour schedule was supposed to be, right, with these full field events as well as the signature events, the full field events are working as they should. They're supposed to be jump-starting the career of a Grayson Murray, or it should be kind of cementing stars like a Nick Dunlap, or even last week with Jake Knapp. It should provide kind of a soft launching point for a player like Austin Eckroat. If there's anything to quibble with this PGA Tour season so far, it has been the signature events. Wyndham Clark, obviously reigning U.S. Open champion, you know his pedigree. Hideki Matsuyama, now Asia's most prolific winner on the PGA Tour. Those are fine players, but Rory's had a very quiet PGA Tour season. Victor Hovland, the reigning FedEx Cup champion, has had a very quiet start. Max Homa, top 10 player in the world, has kind of been MIA so far to this point. If there's anything, it's been the stars not showing up at this point in the PGA Tour schedule, not necessarily the Cognizant Classics of the world.
Well, and part of it, and you have to lean into it, is the star power that has also left the PGA Tour over the past couple of years. And I feel like just, and part of it is just luck on who wins, who gets off to fast starts, but the depth at the top when it comes to star power, usually you'd say 5 to 8 guys are legit stars that move the needle in some way. some of those guys have left to live. So now you have a narrower funnel of players that you would consider stars, who not only when they win are a big story in golf, but then are a first block on ESPN SportsCenter type deal, or like for the general public starts paying attention to it. And I feel like these first nine events, now we're seeing, oh, okay, well, we have lost some guys that could have some importance.
The ranking list that I tend to go back often is the inaugural player impact program, literally the metric that the PGA Tour used to show who is the most popular players on the PGA Tour, who is moving the needle. And LIV, to this point, when you look back at the original rankings from 2021, they have taken six of those 10 players. Six of 10, more than half of the PGA Tour's biggest needle movers are now playing their golf elsewhere. If you include seven with Tiger Woods not playing a full PGA Tour schedule anymore, like, PGA Tour is bereft of star power, and it's the quantity of star power. If you and I sit here, you can name probably four or five bona fide PGA Tour stars, players who, if they go into a restaurant here in Stamford, Connecticut, like, they would probably be recognized. Four or five. Those guys need to show up and perform. And as we sit here at the quarter mark of the PGA Tour season, it just hasn't happened yet.
And one of those guys would be world number two, Rory McIlroy, who's been off to a bit of a slow start, added the Cognizant Classic at the Palm Beaches for the first time since 2018. And you look at what Rory has done. He played well at Dubai in the Hero Dubai Desert Classic, was T2 and then the win. Starting with the West Coast swing, T66 at AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. T24 at the Genesis, T21 now, Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches. He closed with a 68 Sunday evening to get that best finish of the year on the PGA Tour. And afterwards, he spoke with the media on his takeaways from the week.
A week that could have been. I felt like most of my play was a bit better than what the result suggested. You know, that bad hole on 16 yesterday. You know, a few sloppy mistakes here and there, but yeah, overall sort of game seems to be trending in the right direction. I drove the ball great again this week. You know, I led the field in strokes gained off the tee at RIV, probably going to do that again this week. So, you know, if, you know, that's the foundation of my game, and when that's good, then, you know, I just need some of the rest of the pieces to fall into place, and you know, hopefully they can over the next couple of weeks.
Rory, you purposely had a busier 2024. You added this event, you've added Valero to be sharper, you know, more match tough going into Augusta. Yeah. What have you seen so far?
Yeah, it's been, if anything, I'm just learning sort of my patterns and learning how to manage my game a little bit. And, you know, there's still a few misses in there, but at the same time, I know what those misses are, so I know how to manage it a little bit better. So, it's been good. Looking forward to Bay Hill and looking forward to the players too. And, you know, it's been a little stop start since the Middle East. So, you know, looking forward to getting on a run of events here.
Well, unless you really think about your week, you don't realize how hectic it is. When you think about Monday playing at night, playing tomorrow, it's like eight straight days, always something you have to do. What is that like to manage all that?
I mean, I'm really happy I got done today, because it means that I get to join my dad on the most important day of his year tomorrow, so at Seminole. But I guess it's the life that I wanted. It's the life that I've asked for. I'm not going to stand up here and complain. You know, this is what I want to do. I like being busy. I like, I try to not. No one likes being me more than me. So, you know, that's sort of the attitude that I like to go with. And I'm busy, but I like being busy when it's stuff that I want to do.
I love hearing that from Rory. It's the most important day of my dad's year at the Seminole Pro member. How could it not be for Jerry McIlroy to get to play with his son? A little context. Last year, Rory finished, I think it was T29, T32, back-to-back with WM Phoenix Open and then RIV. And then played well at API, was T2 there, played well at match play, and then we had that build up to the Masters. He's changed the schedule around this year, and we heard Damon Hack ask him about adding events. So how do you gauge where Rory's game is at if slipping on the green jacket's the ultimate goal?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I was going to make that point, too, where we're probably one tee shot away in Dubai from having a very different conversation when it comes to Rory McIlroy. Very nearly had the doubleheader in Dubai, and it was almost a mirror image of what we saw last year, and he ended up obviously having a fine year in 2023 and factoring in a couple major championships as well. I actually really like the idea of what Rory's doing in 2024 of adding events and kind of having the spring training where he's going to end up playing eight times before he gets to the year's first major at the Masters. I don't know if he's necessarily been disinterested. Disinterested is not necessarily the right word, but he hasn't been fully engaged, it doesn't seem like. And perhaps that's because of his performance. It's hard to be fully engaged when you're, you know, outside the top 30 at Pebble Beach and the rest of these tournaments. But I think if this continues at Bay Hill, this week's tournament, where he has six career top tens and nine career performances, if it continues at the Players' Championship, the PGA Tour's flagship event, then I think it's fair to wonder where his game is. Certainly there's stuff to clean up, right? The left miss, his putting was not sharp at PGA National, as it hasn't been over these past couple PGA Tour starts as well. But I'm not ready to hit the panic button at all when it comes to Rory McIlroy.
Always fascinated. Each and every year, he seems to come up with a new game plan, tactical approach, mentality, when it leads into Augusta. It's the most important tournament of the year. I'm treating it like any other week. I'm not going to play a ton and then ramp up my game. I'm going to play a lot before then. Any gauge which direction he should look, or do you think his quest year in and year out eventually is going to land on the right number?
I actually like the idea of playing into it. It allows him to see where his game is, and you want to kind of get to the first major championship of the year and then kind of maintain for the next couple of months, as opposed to perhaps, you know, finding it in May or June, and then you end up having a strong FedEx Cup playoffs when you wish you had really peaked for the Masters. So I liked him. He'll have plenty of data. He'll have plenty of evidence to suggest where his game is when he makes a trip down Magnolia Lane. Eight tournament starts is a boatload of competition. It's basically a third of his whole tournament schedule for 2024 is going to happen before the first major championship of the year. He's clearly grasping, trying to find something, and I'm sure you and I would be too if this was so elusive and we're trying to get that first Masters title.
Considering all the media attention, and it's the first major of the year, does Rory face more pressure annually at Augusta than any other pro golfer leading in any other event?
No doubt. And I think it only gets worse with time. He's come in there in good form. He's come in there in poor form. Remember last year, he was playing well heading into it, and he had a practice session at Augusta National, and he said, there's no way that I'm not going to win this tournament. And he ends up missing the cut in what was such a surprising result. I don't think there's any way that he can gird himself for what that week is going to bring. He knows the media attention is going to be suffocating for him. He knows his game is going to be highly scrutinized. It just comes with the territory. It comes with kind of this rarefied air that he has entered, needing that to complete the career Grand Slam. But, you know, compared to Jordan Spieth at a PGA Championship or Phil Mickelson now at a U.S. Open, it pales in comparison to what Rory McIlroy faces at Augusta.
If only he could get one of Tiger's five. Tiger's most recent, of course, in 2019 at the Masters. Seems like a far cry from what we've seen out of Tiger the past couple years after the recovery from that horrific car crash in 2022. Ahead in the show, Tiger Woods teeing it up today in South Florida at the historic Seminole Pro Member, which begs the question, where's he playing next on the PGA Tour as you're watching Golf Today? Back at it on Golf Today. Some news over the weekend as 15-time major champion Tiger Woods has been selected to receive the highest honor from the USGA. That's the Bob Jones Award, which recognizes his commitment to sportsmanship and respect for golf's traditions. Tiger will be honored June 12th during the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. Tiger Woods sharing this, saying that Bob Jones was a pillar of our game because of the integrity with which he played it, and I'm truly humbled to receive the award that bears his name and join the many who have received it before me who continue his legacy. A Tiger, both a historian and a student of the game, clearly means a lot to him. Speaking of the big cat, he's teeing it up today in a tournament he's never played before, the Seminole Pro Member at the iconic Juno Beach, Florida Club, where he will partner with PGA of America CEO Seth Waugh, play against dozens of teams with PGA Tour pros and titans of industry. Woods has generally always been invited by a member in the past, though he never accepted until now. So a little curious after the WD at the genesis for that illness, why today was the good fit for him to tee it up there.
I think he's just desperate for competitive action in any form. I mean, you really can't go to Augusta National expecting, if he plays the Players' Championship, which I think now is kind of the expectation, to play 5.5 tournament rounds and think that you can win the Masters tournament. I'm not saying an 18-hole pro member at Seminole is going to get him ready for Augusta National, but it's getting a scorecard in his hand. It's getting some of those juices going. It's understanding how he feels in that moment. I do find it interesting, though, George, because that was such a setback for what happened at Riviera. I was there that week. I saw him in the practice rounds. I saw him at the Pro-Am. I saw him in the opening round. Like, he looked pretty good. His iron play was sharper than it had been in recent times. You just wonder whether he was going to be able to put in enough time in the short game area and the practice putting green to get sharp enough for tournament competition and to be able to beat the Rorys and the Scotties of the world. What was kind of your take of him playing this week? Obviously, he's not going to be in the field at Bay Hill, but at least he's getting some sort of reps.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't want to call it honorary, but I think it's at the stage of his career where Tiger's more willing to embrace being a part of events like this. And I think he has an appreciation for when he's able to tee it up, whatever level of competition you want to call this. And I think 5 years ago, if you mentioned, or 10 years ago, PGA Tour champions, I think Tiger would have scoffed a little. I think now he's probably kind of looking forward to when he'll be able to play there after turning 50 into the 26th season. I did think Genesis was a setback, and it seems like we're getting a lot of those now. And when we think we have a somewhat clear landscape and Tiger says he's pain-free, and then we start throwing projections here on Golf Today. Oh, here's February. Here's what March will look like. And then he plays the Masters and then the PGA. And then we realize how either frail his body can be at times or how uncertain his future is. Then we come crashing back to the current reality of Tiger, where you just have to take it one tournament at a time. And it's almost a fool's errand to try and project what a whole year will look like.
He spoke so optimistically at the Hero World Challenge at the end of the year where, you know, I'm gonna try and play once a month. And he said, you know, really his lower leg is not all that much of a concern anymore. And if you watched him at Riviera, like, he's moving better than he has been in recent memory, and except in the opening round. He says he was experiencing back spasms and that causes the kinetic chain, and he's, you know, kind of dealing with pain in other areas. And then he gets sick and he has to withdraw on Friday. You want to put your hand on his shoulder and be like, hey, once we play the Players' Championship, we really need to start at the Valspar Championship. Innisbrook would be a great test for you ahead of the Masters. You need to log these competitive reps if you want any chance to win at the Masters. But he can't physically do it.
Body's not able.
The body is not able to do it. I think that's the frustrating part. Because I think we have a large enough sample size now over the past 2 years to know that playing this Hogan-esque schedule of just the major championships, it sounds great in theory, but it's really hard to do. When you have other players, we just talked about Rory McIlroy, right, who's going to be playing 8 times ahead of the Masters. And you have Tiger, who potentially, assuming he makes the cut at the Players' Championship, would have 5.5 rounds, not starts, 5.5 rounds ahead of a major championship. It's just so hard to compete with that much competitive rust.
It's been a conundrum he's been facing since before the car crash. And I had asked him at the 2020 BMW Championship. That was his final start of that season. I was the porter that week. And I said, how do you balance reps with having rest? And that was something he was struggling with then, because his back would flare up a bit and he was saying, I really can't get the reps on off weeks to balance that with the necessary rest to make sure my body's able to compete. Now the pendulum has even swung even more to where rest is going to be like a 95-5 to reps, and it's the hidden hours that make these players great. And his body constrains him for how much he can actually put in. So I think if it's frustrating for us in any sense, the order of magnitude, it's going to be frustrating for Tiger to think, my body used to be able to do this 5, 10, 15 years ago, and now I can't. I have to maximize these narrow windows of time that I have to actually compete and get tournament ready. So it's like an unsolvable riddle.
It really is. And when you think back, and everyone points to the Masters in 2019, when he was still dealing with the back issues. But Tiger Woods played 4, 5, 6 times.
Yeah.
If you look back, heading into Augusta National, gave everything he had to win one last green jacket, and then, you know, had a little bit of another injury setback, and then at the end of the year, he wins the Zozo Championship as well. He just cannot put enough time in. I'm sure that's maddening, just kind of being a victim of your own frail body and your own frail sense that he just doesn't have a lot of time competitively to get this thing right. I'm sure that has to be incredibly frustrating for a proud champion like him.
We had teased the star power that's part of the Seminole Pro member. Let's take a look at some of the names of the other players competing in the field. We know Rory said he's playing with his dad, Jerry. How about Tom Brady teeing it up, MLB commissioner, Rob Manfred, Colin Morikawa, Tony Finau, Justin Thomas.
What the PGA Tour would kill to have this sort of stuff. This is the ultimate signature event, George. This is not a full field event. This is a signature event.
The PGA. Got Nelly Korda in the mix as well, which is great to see. And a name we had been hoping to return to professional golf for years and years and years. And then it finally happened as we're just getting started on golf today. Anthony Kim making his first pro start since 2012. Not the debut he was probably looking for, finishing last on his first LIV debut. We're going to break it down in our roundtable after the break. We've been waiting to see this site since the 2012 Wells Fargo Championship. This was the inaugural tee shot for Anthony Kim in his LIV golf debut in Jeddah. Wondering, how would he look? What would he shoot? What were expectations for a guy who hasn't played in more than a decade? And we certainly saw some rust.
Yep, that's a Hazel Rocket. Somehow, George made five from there. I guess a good bogey, all things considered, but I am intimately familiar with that feeling of hitting nothing but Hazel. I must say, George, you're 38, Anthony Kim, 38. The swag level is still there when it comes to AK. He's got the aviators, he's got the Nikes, he's got the tube socks, the shirt is somewhat untucked. I'm not sure you could pull off the same look.
No chance I could pull that off.
Good.
I had talked with a couple pro golfers leading up to Anthony Kim's debut and just said, okay, what's reasonable from pro to pro? And they're like, if he finishes outside the bottom five, it's an incredible week. He'll probably be bottom three just because of the rust of the first start. So for him finishing last, that's what we're all, I mean, every recap is always last and live. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people were saying that's reasonable as a starting point. Any reason for optimism with what we saw?
You know what? When you look at his scores, it certainly could have been worse. You know, I'm willing to give him grace because we've seen whether it's Tiger, Will Zalatoris, or even Bud Colley to an extent, who took a sabbatical and then was trying to get back on the PGA Tour and rediscover his game. It does take time. And there's a huge difference between being able to shoot 65 in casual rounds at home with your friends and then once you get a scorecard in your hand and being able to do that. And so I mentioned this with Rex Hoggard, who we're going to have on the show here in a second on our podcast last week, and I said this is either going to look genius or foolish by summertime. You know, once he gets 3 to 4 starts under his belt, and we'll see how it is. It does certainly look like the latter at this current time. What I think was most striking to me, George, and the thing that I didn't really understand, is that we still don't know Anthony Kim's motivations. You and I were talking before the show. I can't ever recall a momentous decision that has happened in sports, right? Whether it's a trade or a signing or a retirement, that wasn't preceded by some sort of long-form explanation of why you're doing something.
The only one I can think of is Barry Sanders.
Okay.
And it just doesn't happen. Normally there's a press conference. He only put out a statement to a paper and then left. But for AK, there was no statement, nothing. Just poof.
And so without that context of why he's coming back, it kind of reeks of a move that wasn't made necessarily for competitive reasons or for having a love of the game, and instead it just kind of seems like he's getting the bag and then he'll just disappear once again. And if that's not the case, then Anthony Kim and Liv and his handlers had an opportunity to kind of set the narrative for this comeback. But absent of that, we have no way to judge what we're actually witnessing with his competitive return here.
I'm going to save my thoughts for just a second because let's continue now, have a conversation with Golf Today Roundtable. We welcome Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard, GolfDigest.com senior writer Joel Peel. Rex, let's start with you. What's your big takeaway from Anthony Kim's return?
I think I'm with Lab on this one, George. What did we really expect? He's been gone for 12 years. I think I heard someone mention it during the telecast from PGA National over the weekend, and kind of compared to Michael Jordan going away for 3 years before coming back and being competitive. That was just 3 years. I know basketball is more demanding. I can kind of see where that's coming from, but kind of look at this from Anthony Kim's point of view. It's like he's been in a time capsule for the last 12 years. I mean, he even talked about the idea of trying to remember how to put the scorecard into his back pocket and remember exactly how this was supposed to go down, and also the differences with LIV Golf. So I read much less into what he actually shot. And look, when he spoke after his rounds, there was a good amount of optimism. He felt like he was making sort of some mental errors that he can clean up pretty shortly. The one part that I got hung up on more than anything is I have so many other questions. Like, to Lab's point, I want to know where he's been. I want to know what the narrative is. I want to know what the motivation was to come back. That's the part that hurt me the most.
Joel, along those same lines, AK finishes last by 11 shots. He finished 33 shots behind Joaquin Niemann. How much grace are you willing to give him? How many events before you call his comeback either a success or a failure?
Good question. I think you do have to give him grace, but I just kind of came away from this weekend stunned how anticlimactic it was. I mean, fans waited so long for this, and what they were treated to was a guy playing an easy course in the middle of the night, 6,000 miles away in front of no one. So to me, really the question is about these next couple months. It's going to put the mythology of Anthony Kim to the fire, because how Kim has been discussed over the past decade really had little to do with his play, right? It was mostly based on the fact that he did something that golfers don't do, which is walk away. Certainly, he had some very high points in that career, and that fact that he had an electric persona in an era when golf was very vanilla certainly helped his standing. But as I wrote a month ago, when these rumors about a comeback started to come to fruition, you know, this return, it threatens to tear down the very thing that it was built upon, because it was built upon something that was never there, right? So I hope he does well. It'll be interesting to see if he is an intention magnet that so far LIV has been able to get. But in terms of extrapolating anything of merit based on his play, you really can't say much other than I just hope he wears that white tee and gym shorts and Vans shoes look in a real round rather than a practice round. Frankly, I'm surprised Pat Perez hasn't done that yet either. But yeah, other than that, I don't think he can really say much, at least anything of value, of how Anthony Kim looked this past weekend.
Hey, my two cents, seeing Anthony Kim, amazing story to have him return. To Lab's point, the motivation, is it purely financial, or is it Anthony really wanting to show what he can do to himself, to his family, to people in the golf world? The concerning number for me is ball speeds at 170. That would currently have you 137th on the PGA Tour. I don't think he's equipped to compete right now and live until he makes some serious strides there and really either works on his body and his game as hard as he's ever done in his career the next 3 to 6 months, because that's the only way to overcome the rust that he's facing with 12 years off. And Rex, timeline-wise, the guy's clearly very talented, won 3 times on the PGA Tour. We see this starting point now. If he were to make positive strides, how long an arc would he need going forward?
Well, I think you also need to look at the idea that he's only playing in 54-hole events. It's shotgun starts. You pointed out he's in shorts, he's in tube socks. Like, it's a much different atmosphere than had he landed back on the PGA Tour. So I think that's going to factor into this curve as well. I'm a little bit with Lab on this one. Let's give it well into the summer. I think you need to give him 4 or 5 events to get his feet underneath him, to understand exactly where he is. I am going to take one quick exception. It's clear he got a bag to go to play for LIV Golf. We can all agree on that. But I think his comeback, at least talking with people who know him, who have been around him these last 12 years, he's been toying with the idea of a comeback long before LIV Golf moved into the conversation. And for whatever reason, he chose not to. And maybe now it was just to get paid, but I think the love was always there. It was just a matter of figuring out if he was able to come back.
And Joel, I think the reasonable expectation for Anthony Kim is that he will progress and he will get better over time. He's not going to finish 33 shots behind the eventual winner continuing. However, if it does not improve, if he does continue to finish in the bottom half of the leaderboard, does LIV run the risk of AK's return kind of hitting at the credibility of what they're trying to do and being a competitive and entertainment golf product?
It certainly doesn't help, right? Especially as they're making this case that they deserve world ranking points. Having a guy who hasn't played in a decade get guaranteed starts, that's not going to help the case you're trying to build. But yeah, I just don't know what to expect because, again, well, Kim was very, very good in his prime. He wasn't a top five player, and he's 38 years old with a lot of mileage on him. I know with all the sports science and the way equipment works nowadays, you can have a career well into your 40s. But if you look at the top 30 guys in the world, there's not too many guys outside age 35. So I'm not sure what the ceiling is and what this guy can ultimately do. Again, I hope he turns into the person all the fans are rooting for. That would be fantastic for the sport. But what we can actually expect to see, I just don't envision a guy coming back and being the person everyone wants him to be.
Joel, let's go another one right at you. And it's kind of crazy to think that Joaquin Niemann's about the same age as Anthony Kim was when he left the PGA Tour in 2012. Now, Joaquin has won two times on LIV, his last three starts, and yet again, kind of whines about where world ranking points factor in with the LIV Golf Tour. Do you think that's the most productive way from a messaging standpoint for LIV to keep pushing this forward in their ultimate quest to get world ranking points?
Yeah, I don't know what the right way is to go about this, but this certainly seems the wrong way. And this is all unfortunate because I think Niemann's a very, very good player with a chance to be special, and we'll get a chance to see how he fares at the Masters and PGA Championship coming up. But this continued assault on the world ranking is like, we get it. You're upset. I'd advise putting this feedback into a box, strapping it to a rocket, and shooting in space, though, because that's where it belongs. No one cares. I wish he was this indignant about some of the things his employer has done rather than these world ranking points, but I get it. Message heard. I guess to me, I keep falling back to direct your anger at somebody else. Be upset at Greg Norman for selling these lies to you. Be upset at your team for believing Greg Norman. But one good way not to get world ranking points is continuing to belittle the organizations that award these points. And this, along with the Gooch comments from last week, it just speaks to this rampant entitlement that LIV Golf seems to harbor. Just because one entity handed over undeserved blank checks to you doesn't mean the rest of the sport will do the same, you know? So I just don't understand why they think we should cater to their demands. And listen, Niemann is very good. If we want to have a discussion about LIV's competitive merit, fine. But to me, the moment you argue why you matter is the moment you prove the opposite. And to me, this is what Niemann's doing.
Rex, you posted a story earlier today on golfchannel.com about Joaquin Niemann receiving an invitation to the PGA Championship. From a PGA perspective, what went into that decision, and what do you think that says now about the larger landscape as it relates to LIV players in major championship golf?
I actually think it was a pretty easy decision for the PGA of America. This is pretty much what they do each year. If you go back to last year, any player inside the top 100 who isn't qualified via another category normally gets some sort of special invitation. Last year, 8 LIV players got invitations to play in the PGA Championship, including Paul Casey, who was ranked 131st in the world at the time. So this really wasn't outside the norm for the PGA of America. And you look at what Joaquin has done really over the last few months, winning the Australian Open, and certainly even take what he has done on LIV Golf, having won twice this year. I think Joel's right, though. This is a non-starter. They're wasting their energy on something that they have no control over, and they're not doing themselves any favors instead of focusing on what really matters. That if the world ranking is out of the equation, and we can all agree that we want the best players in the major championships, now the mantle falls to the major championships. They need to decide how to get these players into these events to make sure you're playing against the best in these biggest events. I'll give the PGA of America credit. It seems like they've done it. Certainly Augusta National did it. I think that's a better use of their time and energy and platform.
All right, we're only halfway through this chit chat coming up after this short break. Why is the Seminole Pro member so important to so many big names in the game? And we're going to talk about some sponsors exemptions on the PGA Tour next. Week two of the Florida Swing as Bay Hill hosts a signature event. And it's the game's top players coming to Orlando for the Arnold Palmer Invitational. This presented by MasterCard kicks off Thursday 2 Eastern, first round on Golf Channel and Peacock. How about this from Joel Beal? Said, for the third straight signature event, Adam Scott, who serves as a player director for the tour, receives a sponsor's exemption into Bay Hill. Webb Simpson, another player director, also gets into what is now this week's field via sponsor exemption. So Dylan Wu chimed in. Great players and major champions. I can't say much because I missed the cut. this past week at PGA National, but getting more than one sponsor exemption in Elevate events doesn't seem fair. Seems like if you're a player director, you'll get an invite into Elevated event seems suspect. He continued. And trust me, they're both great players and probably deserve it, but this new model is all about meritocracy, sponsor exemptions. Going to the same players every Elevated event doesn't seem to follow the play better saying. Seems like be more famous or know the right people, quote unquote. Went on to say, I'm not saying I deserve an exemption anyway. I don't and must play better to get in the Elevated events. There's eight this year. The points in these big events are worth 2.5x more and purses are double with half the field size. That makes these exemptions so important, almost a golden ticket, quote unquote. So continuing on golf today, as we welcome back Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard and GolfDigest.com senior writer Joel Beal. Joel, you started this chain reaction with Dylan Wu chiming into the conversation. Your thoughts to what he had to share?
Yeah, I wrote an ensuing column about the subject, and I heard from about a half a dozen tour pros who agree with Dylan Wu. You know, that players like Scott and Simpson and even Peter Malinati, who received a sponsor exemption at Pebble Beach, that they're being rewarded for what they're doing, I think is understandable. These guys are sacrificing their time and energy to help shape the PGA Tour's future and secure that future. And certainly compared to some of the other motos we've seen, how sponsor exemptions have been used in the past, which, you know, range from celebrity, sponsor affiliation, nepotism in some cases, bestowing spots for kind of the work and efforts you're doing on the tour, I mean, it makes sense. The problem is, even with good intentions, cronyism, even the optics of cronyism is still cronyism. And we expect that in other aspects of life, but in golf, there's supposed to be no special treatment. As Dylan mentioned, this is supposed to be a meritocracy. Adam Scott has at least been playing well. He's still a top 50 player. Webb Simpson has two top 10s since, I think, 2021. He is someone that I understand he's a Wake Forest product. He does have ties to Bay Hill. But if these events are the events that are supposed to matter, either they shouldn't have sponsor exemptions or we need to be a little more democratic in how they're awarded rather than the optics of giving a spot to someone just because of their leadership position with the tour.
Rex, that's the exact question I wanted to throw your direction. Should the PGA Tour do away with sponsor exemptions and signature events?
Yes, absolutely. But the sponsors were never allowed that. And since they're paying the bills, I think the PGA Tour is kind of stuck. And look, I think Joel is correct. This is what the tour and the signature events have wrought. This has always been an issue on the PGA Tour, but no one really dug into it because you didn't have these limited field events that gave out so many points and so much more money and meant so much to the entire membership. I talked about this just a few weeks ago on one of these roundtables about how many sponsor exemptions Charlie Hoffman got last year on the PGA Tour. I think he played and 11 or 12 more events out of his category than the next closest person. So you get an idea of what it means to be a player director on the policy board. I understand where the tour is coming from. They do want to reward these guys. We talked about it earlier this last week about it was a 7-hour policy board meeting. I mean, you're putting these guys in a really, really difficult position. But now that the signature events mean so much, yes, if they could get rid of the sponsor exemptions, that would be the easiest answer. I don't see that happening. I think what they need to do is just start giving them out based on merit, based on what players have done on the golf course.
My thinking is if they have sponsor exemptions, then they should be able to do as they see fit. But I agree with Joel where at least mix it up a little bit so you throw off the scent of any cronyism compared to what we've seen so far where it's just so abundantly clear. Final question. We see Tiger Woods teeing it up for the first time in the Seminole Pro member. Rex, for the average golf fan who's unfamiliar with this event, why is it so important to so many pros?
Well, first, you're playing a really, really cool, iconic golf course. It's usually warm, and you're playing with a really, really powerful person who's a member at Seminole Golf Club. I heard Lab talking earlier. I'm sure Tiger Woods is going to go out and decide, okay, from a physical standpoint, how does it feel to walk 18 holes with a scorecard in my hand? But having covered it quite a few times, I can tell you from the tour pros' perspective, it's a very relaxed atmosphere. I don't think Tiger's going to take anything from his game going into whatever his next start is going to be. Now, some of the members take it very, very seriously, starting with Rory McIlroy's father, who calls it his only major of the year. But I think from the player perspective, it's a lot of fun to go out. When you look at Tiger Woods, I think this is less about reps than it is about business. He's playing alongside Seth Wall, the CEO of the PGA of America this morning, and there's a lot of important people in this field.
guessing they'll have a few topics of conversation that they can cover during the course of that round for the Seminole Pro Member. For Rex Hager, Joe Beal, guys, thanks for joining us for the roundtable here on Golf Today.